Hello, this is Tamara, reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, May 7th. Let's start with the front page. From the Decatur City Council, we have a photo of Consuelo Cruz listening during a presentation at the Monday, April 5th Decatur City Council meeting. Cruz was elected to the council April 1st and was sworn in prior to the start of Monday's meeting. Cruz is ready to work. Premier microbiologist excitedly sworn in as new councilwoman, from Brendan Moore in Decatur. Consuelo Cruz's path to a public office started with a grassroots effort to get a little free library built in Hess Park. Cruz, 51, takes her granddaughter there to read books and wanted other children to have the same experience. Without a bookmobile, she said city leaders had to be more proactive in reaching kids for literacy. That effort is still in the works, but on its way to fruition in collaboration with the Coalition of Neighborhood Organizations, CONO. And it ended up not being the only thing Cruz got out of the experience. Through that experience, I learned that my neighbors had a lot of challenges in the city, Cruz said. A lot of them were retired and didn't know how to access resources that are available. I saw some gaps and an opportunity where I could contribute something, and that's where my interest began. So Cruz, a microbiologist at Premient, ran for Decatur City Council. She picked up the endorsements of the Decatur Trades and Labor Assembly and the Central Illinois Political Action Committee, which is the political arm of the Decatur Regional Chamber of Commerce, along the way. And in the April 1 election, she placed in the top three out of five candidates, securing a seat on the seven-person body. On Monday, Cruz officially became a city councilwoman after taking the oath of office alongside Councilman Ed Culp and David Horn, who each won re-election. Cruz, a Decatur native, told the Herald and Review following the meeting that she was excited to have the opportunity to contribute something to her hometown. "I'm feeling great. I'm ready to get to work," Cruz said. "I am a scientist and I do project management in my day-to-day role, so I look forward to applying some of that to getting some goals accomplished here as a city councilwoman." Cruz said that her top priority will be improving relationships with the other taxing bodies in the community, particularly Decatur Public Schools. She suggested forming a committee comprised of officials from the various bodies that would meet semi-regularly. She said this could help foster collaboration and accountability in meeting the shared goals of the community. Some council members said they were open to the idea, though others suggested that relations were already improving. "That impacts having people who are employable. That impacts the declining population," Cruz said, of the importance of education. "So keeping the tax base by keeping citizens here, that's definitely a priority. Also, through education, we can also have an impact on crime. So I think we have a great team of people here that are working together on the council, and I can add an additional perspective that can build out that team." Though some candidates ruled out any tax and fee increases during the campaign, Cruz said she will take things on a case-by-case basis, describing herself as a community-focused leader who will do what is best for Decatur. One issue Cruz could be a pivotal vote on is whether to revisit the issue of permitting recreational cannabis sales within Decatur city limits. The council voted in 2019 to block dispensaries from locating in town. Efforts to revisit the ordinance have cropped up occasionally in intervening years, but have always fallen short. Councilman David Horn and Dennis Cooper have consistently supported revisiting the issue. Councilman Ed Culp said he would support changing course if a majority of voters in a referendum say yes to allowing them. Cruz struck a similar tone to Culp. "So, regardless of my personal feelings towards that, if we have a referendum and the population says this is something we want to move forward with, we should respect the results of those referendums," Cruz said. Cruz has four adult children and a granddaughter. Again, from our front page, healthcare. Bill may set hospital staff minimums. From Grace Friedman, Metal Illinois News Bureau, Springfield. Healthcare unions continue to rally for legislation to address understaffing they say strains hospitals and threatens both patient safety and staff well-being. Lawmakers are considering the hospital worker staff and safety bill, which would establish mandatory nurse-to-patient staffing ratios and increase support for underfunded hospitals. The proposed legislation, Senate Bill 21 and House Bill 3512, aims to establish minimum staffing ratios in hospitals and fund critical safety net hospitals across the state. Advocates with healthcare worker unions have been holding a series of rallies at the Capitol in support of the legislation in recent weeks. "Our hospitals are staffed unsafely," Kawana Gant, a certified nursing assistant at UChicago Medicine Ingalls Memorial Hospital in Harvey, said at a recent statehouse rally. "I've worked short shifts where there are 30 patients and only one CNA on the floor. How can you give quality care? It is not safe." Gant, who has worked at Ingalls Hospital for nearly 30 years, says she has watched many of her colleagues quit due to the mental and physical toll the short staffing has had on their bodies. But similar versions of the proposed legislation have been introduced at the Statehouse for recent years and have failed to gain traction. Generally backed by unions representing nurses, such as the Service Employees International Union, previous staffing ratio measures have run into opposition from hospital groups that say they're unworkable. The proposed legislation filed this year has yet to receive a hearing in a substantive committee, meaning it will be an uphill battle for it to move by the time the legislature adjourns at the end of the month. Like previous versions, it would mandate that hospitals employ and schedule sufficient staff to ensure quality patient care and safety. In addition, hospitals would have to share annual staffing metrics with the Illinois Department of Public Health to help ensure they are at proper staffing levels. "This bill gives you a real voice," Representative Cam Buckner, Democrat Chicago, said to rallygoers. "It gives you a way to speak up when things are unsafe for you and the people who you care for." However, not all lawmakers are convinced that now is the right time to implement staffing ratios. "You can mandate the staffing ratios, but if those professionals don't exist, what have you really done?" said Representative Noreen Hammond, Republican Macomb. "We've been trying for years to get more people into the healthcare field, especially after COVID, and we're just not there yet." Hammond expressed concern that enforcing strict staffing requirements without enough qualified workers in the pipeline could place unrealistic burdens on hospitals. She warned that such mandates might unintentionally strain facilities already struggling with labor shortages and lead to adverse financial consequences, especially for smaller or rural hospitals. Hospital trade groups echo those concerns, calling the legislation unworkable, burdensome, and an ineffective way to solve a problem that should be addressed by the specific needs of each hospital or care center. The Illinois Health and Hospital Association, the Association of Safety Net Community Hospitals, and the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network issued a statement saying they strongly oppose HB 3512. They said it was introduced as a backdoor effort pushed by organized labor to impose unworkable government-imposed health care staffing ratios in Illinois. "This proposal would relegate the essential, complex, and nuanced protocols established to safely and efficiently staff a hospital 24/7, 365, to a series of burdensome forms and onerous paperwork that hospitals would be required to submit to the IDPH to establish minimum staffing standards for every hospital worker in each hospital unit," the group said in the statement. Still, according to a recent Service Employees International Union survey of Chicago area hospital workers, 70% of respondents reported understaffing and over 25% reported unsafe or unmanageable workloads. Additionally, in the same survey, 47% of the respondents stated an intent to leave their jobs soon. To help ensure safety standards, the legislation introduces assignment despite objection forms that give hospital workers the opportunity to document and report any assignments that they believe are unsafe. Hospitals are then required to provide this information to IDPH, which would have to publish an annual report on all these staffing metrics. The legislation would also require IDPH to make recommendations for minimum staffing standards for hospital workers in each hospital unit. As the legislation stagnates at the Capitol, hospital workers and advocates say they plan to keep organizing and sharing their stories. They said they're calling on lawmakers to prioritize frontline healthcare workers and the patients who depend on them. Grace Friedman is a student in the Medill School of Journalism's Illinois News Bureau. She can be reached at Grace Friedman, 2025, at u.northwestern.edu. Capital News, Illinois, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. Now, our last article from the front page, 2026 Senate race. Representative Kelly joins race for Senate. Second Dem candidate describes herself a lifelong underdog. From Brendan Moore in Springfield. Casting herself as an underdog, U.S. Representative Robin Kelly, Democrat, Madison, launched her campaign for the United States Senate on Tuesday. Kelly, 68, is the second major Democrat to throw her hat into what's expected to be a crowded ring to replace retiring Senator Dick Durbin, who announced 2 weeks ago that he would not seek a sixth term in the upper chamber. Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton declared her candidacy less than a day after Durbin's announcement and quickly rolled out endorsements from the state's top two Democrats, Governor J.B. Pritzker and Senator Tammy Duckworth. Other Democrats are expected to give the race a look, including Representative Raja Krishnamurthy and Representative Lauren Underwood. State Treasurer Mike Frericks on Monday said that he would not run for Durbin's seat. On the Republican side, Representative Darren LaHood, Republican Peoria, has expressed interest. Kelly's entry into the race once again puts her on the opposite side of Pritzker in his political operation. The billionaire governor backed opponents to Kelly when she ran for chair of the Democratic Party of Illinois in 21 and 22. Kelly won the first race but dropped her bid for a full term when Pritzker's candidate, State Representative Lisa Hernandez, Democrat Cicero, secured the necessary votes. In this race, Stratton is expected to receive financial backing from Pritzker in addition to his endorsement. In a 2.5-minute introductory video, Kelly, looking directly at the camera, acknowledged her unfavored status, saying, "You could say I've been an underdog my whole life." She then weaved in elements of her life story, described the early mornings and long days working at her family's mom-and-pop grocery store, and working herself through college to the legislative battles she waged against the gun lobby in Springfield and Washington. "But our situation now, this is a whole different moment," Kelly said. "That's why I'm running for the United States Senate, to fight for health care that doesn't bankrupt families, for wages that lift people up, for housing that's affordable, for neighborhoods safe from gun violence. These are the issues and the people I'm fighting for." "Donald Trump, he may think he's a king and can order people around," Kelly said, "but I don't take orders from him. I'm standing up for you because I'll keep fighting however I have to." Kelly, who's served in the U.S. House since 2013, brings a unique perspective to the race. Her congressional district stretches from Chicago's south side and south suburbs all the way down to Danville, making her one of the few federal lawmakers who represents the city, suburbs, and downstate. She recently hosted a town hall on the campus of Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, which is Republican Representative Mary Miller's turf. It's part of a national effort by Democrats to hold meetings in Republican districts. "My philosophy is that whether you are urban, suburban, or rural, most people want a job and a roof over their head. They want health care. They want a good education for their kids," Kelly told the crowd. "People bring up the same concerns, and it's around a lot of those kitchen table issues." A native New Yorker, Kelly first came to Illinois to attend Bradley University in Peoria, where she subsequently lived for 2 decades. After relocating to the south suburbs, Kelly was elected to 2 terms in the Illinois House. She resigned in 2007 to become then-Treasurer Alexei Gianulis's chief of staff. Kelly sought Gianulis's job in 2010 when he opted to run for U.S. Senate. She lost the general election to Dan Rutherford. In 2013, she won a special election to the congressional seat vacated by Jesse Jackson, Jr. Her campaign emphasized the issue of gun control, a message that was backed up by millions from a political action committee bankrolled by former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. In 21, Kelly won a razor-thin election to succeed former House Speaker Michael Madigan as chair of the Democratic Party of Illinois. She received Durbin's backing and defeated a candidate supported by Pritzker. But the honeymoon was short. Just over a year later, Kelly was deposed at the behest of Pritzker and his allies, who expressed long-standing concern that she was not the best fit for the job since she's a federal office holder, which means she is barred from raising or controlling soft money used in state and local races. Kelly, facing certain defeat, dropped her bid for re-election as party chair. Kelly will likely begin the race at a financial disadvantage. She had about $2 million in her campaign account as of the end of March. Krishnamurthy, who is expected to launch a campaign soon, had about $19 million in the bank. Stratton did not report any numbers, but is expected to receive support from Pritzker. 2 weeks in, the race to succeed Durbin continues to take shape. In addition to Kelly's entry, Frerichs took himself out of consideration after flirting with a bid. Frerichs, the state's chief investment officer since 2015, told supporters in an email that he had aspired to follow in Senator Durbin's footsteps. But the father of a teenager and two-year-old twins said he was not willing to travel to Washington, D.C. 30-some weeks a year and spend so many nights away from my children. There's a mess in Washington right now, and we need to send someone who will fight for all of us in Illinois, but that person will not be me, Frerichs said, hinting that he would instead run for a fourth term as treasurer. In local news from Scott Perry in Decatur, vacant Wood Street home reignites. A vacant home that has been the site of multiple fires prompted yet another response Monday by the Decatur Fire Department. Firefighters arrived at 658 East Wood Street to find the home fully involved in fire, Fire Chief Neil Elder said in a news release. Elder said initial focus was to knock down the heavy fire coming from the home and prevent its spread to nearby buildings. Additional responding crews assumed defensive positions outside the structure. Truck 1, equipped with a 100-foot aerial bucket, and Truck 2, with a 107-foot aerial ladder, were instrumental in extinguishing the fire and allowed firefighters to operate more safely during fire suppression and overhaul efforts, Elder said. No occupants were inside the home at the time of the incident. The cause of the fire, which Elder described as suspicious, is under investigation by department inspectors. From Brendan Moore in Decatur, Decatur orders body cameras. The Decatur Police Department is set to receive what a city official say is a necessary, albeit expensive, upgrade to the systems that manage the department's body-worn cameras, in-car video, interview room recordings, and digital evidence. The City Council on Monday voted 6-1 to approve a 5-year, $2.76 million contract with Arizona-based Axon Enterprise Incorporated that will provide for new body-worn cameras and the software suite to back them up. They will replace a fragmented, outdated set of systems primarily provided through Panasonic that city officials say are unreliable, inefficient, and not purpose-built for public safety. Technology is the name of the game in the public safety space now and in the future, and unfortunately it's not cheap, said Police Chief Shane Brandell. Brandell said that a lot of the money is already money that we spend anyway, estimating that the annual difference over the department's current cost for the technology at around $150,000. But he said it was worth it. There's a reason they own 80% of the market space, Brandell said. It's just because their product is superior. Among the upgrades will be a switch from a server to a cloud-based storage system. This will allow for body cam footage to automatically upload straight from the police car. The department also will have access to transcription and redaction services that utilize artificial intelligence. Brandell said this could serve as a force multiplier by reducing the amount of time officers spend filing out incident reports. Sergeant Todd Kester, representing the Police Benevolent and Protective Association, PBPA, Decatur Unit 39, said the change will lead to less time behind desks and more time face-to-face with the community. We've seen how this technology protects both our officers and the public, Keister said. It helps resolve disputes quickly, reduces false complaints, and supports accountability. These tools don't just record the job, they enhance how we do it. All Decatur officers have worn body cameras since 2020, and all Illinois law enforcement officers are now required to wear them. Macon County State's Attorney Diane Curry wrote a letter of support for the change, calling it a critical step towards modernizing our justice process. The ability to easily share digital evidence between law enforcement and the state's attorney's office will reduce delays, ease discovery burdens, and improve case outcomes, Khoury said. The lone no vote came from new councilwoman Consuelo Cruz, who said she was concerned about the cost. It was over $500,000 annually with a 5-year contract, Cruz said. I think we're in a time of fiscal instability and uncertainty, and I don't think we're in a great position to make those types of financial commitments. The new cameras and systems are expected to be delivered by July. From Tony Reed in Decatur, man gets prison term for shooting vehicle. The Decatur man accused of venting his rage at his ex-girlfriend's current boyfriend by peppering his car with gunfire has been sent to prison for 6 years. Nicholas G. Lynch, 28, had been facing charges of attempted murder in the gun violence, which dates to the afternoon of January 24, 2024, outside the former girlfriend's home in the 1700 block of East Johns Avenue. But Lynch took a plea deal negotiated by defense attorney Chidibir Wachuku that saw the attempted murder count dropped while he pleaded guilty to a charge of the unlawful possession of weapons by a felon. Macon County Circuit Court Judge Jeffrey Geisler also dismissed two further charges, alleging the aggravated discharge of a firearm and one count of criminal damage as part of the plea deal. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department said Lynch arrived to confront the current boyfriend of his ex-girlfriend, who is also the mother of his child, and had broken out the windows on the current boyfriend's car with a billy club. Detective Jason Hess, who signed the affidavit, said the girlfriend managed to flee inside her house with the child while Lynch's truck, driven by an accomplice, was used to ram her boyfriend's car. The boyfriend then managed to slam his vehicle into reverse and speed away from the confrontation and told police that is when Lynch pulled a gun. Lynch shot at his vehicle approximately 10 times, said Hess. He said police patrol officers who interviewed the boyfriend said he had cuts on his left hand caused by flying glass shattered by bullets. The vehicle had multiple smashed windows, front end damage, a flat passenger side tire, and a bullet hole in a back pillar next to the rear window. Lynch's case had been set for a pretrial hearing April 24th, but he made a surprise appearance on April 2nd when he said he would accept the plea deal. Passing sentence, Geisler also agreed to recommend Lynch for substance abuse treatment while he is incarcerated. Now, part one from our opinion page, is college worth it? Yes. Higher education strengthens democracy. From James Rosen, who is a former political reporter and Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. When I grew up, attending college was a badge of honor. It was increasingly required for a successful career. It was widely praised for helping young people become adults and for fueling American prosperity. I remember watching public interest TV ads extolling the benefits of a college education and at least implicitly warning that a high school diploma was no longer a ticket to success. A generation earlier, higher education was so deeply valued that Congress passed a law, the GI Bill, to reward military veterans with low-cost or even free college tuition, affordable home mortgages, and other benefits. Today, attending college faces strong headwinds. Costs skyrocketed to at least $25,000 a year at public universities and four times as much at coveted private schools. Despite these costs, it is more challenging to gain acceptance to better colleges because of baby boomer parents pushing their kids to get ahead. We also have a president who accuses professors of liberal indoctrination and cuts funding for academic research. Some young people, especially men, are delaying or eschewing college. Female university students increasingly outnumber male students. Colleges have experienced tumult before. In the Red Scare of the 50s, students faced accusations, often unfounded, of being communists. A decade later, Vietnam War protests rocked campuses and sometimes turned violent. But the hyper-competitiveness of college today is new. Though I edited my high school newspaper and earned national writing awards in a fine suburban Detroit public education system, my B-plus average never would have been good enough today to get me into my alma mater, the University of California at Berkeley. As an academic tutor who sometimes helps high schoolers complete their college applications, I'm stunned by how cutthroat applying to college has become. The University of Virginia near where I live is one of the country's best public schools, but still a notch or two below the Ivies and other private universities such as Duke, Stanford, and MIT. Yet I have seen stellar students with extraordinary extracurricular activities and community service, even those with 4.1 or 4.2 above A grade point averages, get rejected at Virginia. As for President Donald Trump's indoctrination claim, it is true that many professors, especially at the elite schools, are liberal. That is what I hear almost uniformly when folks learn that I attended Berkeley, with its reputation as the cradle of the 1960s student movement. Far less known, however, is that it was a breeding ground for spies where professors secretly recruited agents for the CIA. The greatest professors make college worthwhile. I still remember the thrilling lectures and thought-provoking seminars of Karen Hermassi, a young political theory professor who taught a course on Plato. She pushed back against then-prevailing academic views of the ancient Greek philosopher as an ideological harbinger for 20th-century dictators from Hitler to Mussolini. While I came to disagree with her, her inspiring lectures helped teach me invaluable lessons about challenging accepted wisdom and reading even dense texts closely. And they taught me another lesson. However abstract it seems at the time, what you learn in college might prove more relevant than you ever imagine. Our debates over Plato and totalitarianism seem distant from the America I'd grown up in, but today, in the America of Trump, no debate is more vital. That vitality has given attending college a new mission to help save American democracy. With some of the world's finest universities under attack from their own government, it is no longer enough to gain an education. Young learners must model the critical role of higher education in the self-governance our founders sought. And they must demonstrate to their countrymen that the free exchange of ideas will help us preserve our government of self-rule. We'll read the second opinion column. Is college worth it? No, universities are too expensive, radical, in the second half hour of our newspaper reading. In our food section today, we have a wonderful idea for Mother's Day. They suggest you might seek out a particularly cute vintage jelly jar and spoon to gift with your homemade strawberry jam. Or you could also bake up a batch of homemade scones, biscuits, or muffins to go with it. We have a recipe for protein pancakes, which involves whole wheat, flour, and the secret ingredient of cottage cheese. Today in history, on May 7th, 1915, a German U-boat torpedoed and sank the British liner RMS Lusitania off the southern coast of Ireland, killing 1,198 people, including 128 Americans out of the nearly 2,000 on board. In 1945 on this date, Nazi Germany signed an unconditional surrender at Allied headquarters in Reims, France, ending its role in World War II. In 1954, the 55-day Battle of Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam ended with Vietnamese insurgents overrunning French forces. It would be the last major battle of the First Indochina War. In 1975, President Gerald R. Ford formally declared an end to the Vietnam era. In Ho Chi Minh City, formerly Saigon, the Viet Cong celebrated its takeover. In 1984 on this date, Monsanto and six other chemical companies agreed to pay a $180 million settlement to Vietnam veterans who were exposed to the chemical herbicide Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. In 2020, Georgia authorities arrested a white father and son and charged them with murder in the February shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery, a black man they had pursued in a truck after spotting him running in their neighborhood near the port city of Brunswick. The two men and a third white man would be convicted of murder in state court and hate crimes in federal court. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, May 7th. Please stay tuned.